Good morning, folks. It's time for Democratic Perspective, brought to you by the Verde Valley Independent Democrats, a weekly talk show about the crucial political issues facing the Verde Valley, Sedona, Northern Arizona, and the nation at large. Join us for a stimulating, thought-provoking discussion. You'll get the facts as we focus on the challenges facing everyone. Good morning, folks. Welcome to Democratic Perspective. Steve Williamson here. Sitting across from me is Mike Cosentino.
The infamous and isolated.
And difficult.
Well, we got a really good show today. This is unusual. We got, this is happening more and more. We have Miles Taylor. We do encourage you to look him up, but he was chief of staff. I said I wasn't going to do the introduction, but he was chief of staff for the Secretary of Homeland Security a while back and has since become a Biden supporter. That's the really short story.
I think to characterize him, I don't know how he'd like this, but the press has characterized him. I think it was Rubin in the Times as, you know, the highest ranking Trump official to actually oppose the reelection of Donald Trump. Klaus von Studerheim is the other interviewer. He's on the other line. And tell us a little, how did you get to this position? Powerful, interesting, exciting, responsible position as chief of staff at Homeland Security.
Yeah, well, Mike and Steve and Stuart, thanks for having me. I do appreciate it. It's good to be back here in Arizona. I'd say this. When Donald Trump got elected, I'd spent most of my career working in national security in Washington, D.C. I'm a product of 9/11. I'm someone who went into government service to prevent another 9/11, and that's what I've been focused on. So I came in at the beginning and was in the administration for 2.5 years. First joined John Kelly when he became DHS secretary. He had me come into the department to serve as his national security advisor. So I was handling things like counterterrorism, Russian interference in U.S. democracy, cybersecurity, and those types of issues. Eventually, partway through the administration, became the deputy chief of staff and took over as chief of staff at the Department of Homeland Security. And then, of course, my portfolio brought to border and immigration issues. But I didn't know Donald Trump, and a lot of us didn't know Donald Trump. But we came in because I think there was a fear at the beginning that if the president brought a lot of the lackeys at Trump Tower into the administration, and that's who ran the government, we would have a not as well functioning government. So you saw some pretty good people answer the call who didn't know Trump, like John Kelly, like Jim Mattis, like Rex Tillerson. And arguably the president had a pretty strong cabinet at the beginning of the first term. But again, these guys really wanted to, do what was right and come in and serve. And I felt the same way. I'd known John Kelly for some years. He was the commander at U.S. Southern Command, and had really admired what he'd done in the Pentagon. He had a great reputation, and decided it made sense to come in and help him really focus on emerging threats. And that was our initial goal at DHS. Our goal coming in was to really focus on those areas where Homeland Security needed to evolve, and that was on the digital battlefield, and of course against threats like foreign nations interfering in our democratic process. Those were our big concerns. Now, I'll tell you, bottom line up front, that isn't what we got to focus most of our time on, because the president had very different priorities and a very different agenda.
It seems like you had a kind of house or a building of priorities and challenges and stuff all prepared based on your experience. Kelly's based on his experience. You arrive at Homeland Security, and you find that it's like, what would you call it? Almost like a castle of sand, a building of sand because of Donald Trump's behavior, right?
Well, look, I mean, to tell you the truth, if you just thought of Homeland Security as we're going to mix a bunch of metaphors today together, but if you thought of it as like an apple pie and it's sitting there, you've got a decent slice of apple pie in the Homeland Security tin that is border security and immigration. That's a focus. There's no doubt. But then you've got another slice that, like I said, is cybersecurity, and another slice that's keeping terrorists out of America and from killing Americans, and another slice that's emergency response, wildfires and hurricanes. And then you have kind of, you've got a more complete picture there of what the department should do. When Donald Trump looked at that pie, he saw the entire thing, or 95% of it, as border security and immigration, and just wanted to gobble it up. And then the crumbs that fell off of his lips were all of those other things that I listed that Americans should be concerned about. The consequence was that by focusing the department inordinately on just that one slice and turning it into the whole pie, we did not get to devote enough time and attention to those other issues as we should have. And as a result, I genuinely think, and this is the reason why I came out against the president, I genuinely think the country is less safe than it otherwise would have been if Donald Trump hadn't looked at that pie so wide-eyed and through the wrong lens.
Miles Taylor, Trump's administration, Homeland Security. I want to ask the tough question right up front here. Since you just said these guys spent so much time on his pet project, and that was the border, that which created division in America and certainly caused some of the most inhumane actions that this country has ever been involved in, did he actively discourage you from investigating the Russia involvement in the 2016 election?
That's a great question. I wouldn't say that the president explicitly directed us not to look into Russian interference, but what I will say is this. The president created a very clear culture of intimidation within the administration around anything related to Russia. If you brought up Russia with the president, you better be prepared for Donald Trump to not say the thing you wanted him to say. And what do I mean by that specifically? What I mean specifically is if we went to the president and said, we need to punish the Russians harder for interfering in our country, the concern was the president might come back and actually say, wait, you're thinking about punishing the Russians? I don't want you to do that. And so there were different camps in the administration. There were some of us who believed, look, the threat is so severe from countries like Russia, we have to inform the president of the United States, and we have to convince him to care about it. There were others that were much more cynical who thought, it's too late. You can't convince the president to do the right thing on Russia. It's much better for us to not bring it up and do what we can try to do kind of below the presidential level. And that led to a lot of fights between staffers and aides and people like John Bolton when he was National Security Advisor and us. There were really differences of opinion about how often this should be raised to the president's level. I still firmly believe, even if Donald Trump has a deep affinity for Vladimir Putin, the president of Russia, I still believe it's important for the commander-in-chief to be regularly briefed on the threats to the country. I think the president should have been convinced by his aides how dangerous the Russians actually were, even if it was futile, even if he wasn't going to agree, and be given the opportunity to change his mind. Now, we all know Donald Trump. He doesn't change his mind a whole lot unless, you know, it's in his own self-interest. But that was important to do. And because that didn't get done, again, that's another area where our country is less safe. Right now, in the 2020 election cycle, Moscow is interfering in U.S. affairs. They're spreading disinformation, and they potentially have other plans. But it's not just the Russians anymore. Because the president didn't act after 2016, it's now the Chinese are in the game, the Iranians are in the game, and there are other countries saying, you know, this might be worth our time, is to spend some money sending intelligence operatives and disinformation into the United States to try to disrupt their democratic process, to harm America, and to help those adversarial countries. So because Trump failed on Russia in the beginning, we now have more bad guys that are trying to do the same thing.
Disinformation sounds like just the tip of the iceberg, though, Miles. And, you know, actually, compared to actual digital interference with our election, disinformation sounds almost mild compared to some of the other things that could be going on. I mean, I don't know if China is going to get involved in the U.S. election simply to spread disinformation. They're going to, or Russia for that matter. They're going to try to all. Are they not? May I ask you a question? Are they not going to try to alter numbers?
Let me follow that up with another question. What is it that these, countries you are trying to interfere? What do they expect to gain from it?
Yeah, that's a really good question. Stuart, let me take yours first, and then I want to jump back to all three numbers. What do they want to gain? Now, they each have slightly different motivations. If you're the Russians really care about diminishing the United States by getting the American political system so riled up and so dysfunctional that they, Russia, by comparison, look like a sober, thoughtful leader on the world stage. There's nothing Vladimir Putin wants more than to be seen as a peer of the United States and to increase his power in his region, which he thinks he can do more effectively if the United States loses influence. That's really his goal. Wants to make America look bad so he looks better. And I'm not oversimplifying that. I mean, we really know that that's what they're thinking, because they talk about it openly and publicly, and it's very clear. When it comes to the Chinese or the Iranians, but we'll focus on the Chinese, they have more, in my view, more insidious designs. And the Chinese government really wants to change U.S. policies on key issues to benefit China and to allow for the Chinese rise, but also to make America vulnerable in the event that there might be potential armed conflict in the future between the two countries. And the Chinese are playing the long game. I mean, the Russians are very short-sighted, and they'll do opportunistic, reckless things in the short term to benefit themselves. The Chinese have a very long-term focus on the United States and beating the United States on the world stage, not just being seen as a peer. The Chinese want global dominance. That's their objective. They've spelled it out. And their interference, like I said, is more insidious because it's designed in the long run to defeat the United States on many, many issues, from the economy to military strength around the world. And so I think that's where we have to be more worried in the long term.
Except for military strength, it seems like they're succeeding quite well. I mean, so they're worried about things like Hong Kong. They're worried about changing our policy in Taiwan. Those things that have been longstanding U.S. policies that have served the issue, the cause of freedom and democracy, they want to change those things. Is that what I'm...
They do.
Yeah.
They do. And they want to put their thumb on the scales in our political system to make sure that the right people, in quotes, that the right people get elected so that over time America has much more favorable policies towards China or is just weaker in general abroad. And that's why we see the Chinese investing in things like state and local elections, not just at the federal level, and really investing in state and local communities where they don't have the information or the intelligence to know that they're being manipulated by Beijing. And that really is happening. And they're playing that long game. But I don't want to forget the other question about altering numbers, though. I think this is an important point because, you know, my concern about the threat from these governments may sound hyperbolic. It's not. But I do want to temper it in one place, and that is I feel very confident that with what we've done in the past 4 years since the 2016 election, that the actual integrity of the voting process itself is stronger than it was in 2016. It's much, much harder now than it would have been back then for an adversary government to try to break into our systems and change things like actual vote tally. And that's because despite the president not caring about this issue, DHS, the FBI, and the intelligence community spent a ton of time and money the past few years going all around the country to every single voting district in America and working with governments to try to tighten up those processes, protect their cyber systems with a lot more robust defenses, and put in place best practices. So I actually think the vote tallying process, the actual physical aspects of voting, are stronger and safer, perhaps than they've ever been, because of those efforts. That said, our adversaries are more emboldened than ever because Donald Trump did not do enough at his level, at the White House level, to discourage.
Let me ask you a question, because American foreign policy tends to be short-sighted, too. Chinese have always played the long game. When Russia collapsed, when Soviet Union collapsed, we ended up with Russia. It shrank into a poverty, worse poverty, I guess, than it had. It became extraordinarily weak. It went from being a superpower to being just a player in Europe and Asia around it. China's the second largest country in the world in terms of its economy. All these countries, when they come up from the bottom, as China did and Russia did in a much shorter span, are extremely aggressive. So what is our long game to deal with the aggression of the fact that the Chinese are looking around and saying, well, hey, we're the biggest country in the world, and the Russians are saying, look, we were really mistreated by the West when our economy collapsed. How do you play a long game and understand what their thinking is?
Yeah, look, if I was going to boil it down, I would say the only way for the United States to play the long game is to fight forward with freedom. And that sounds like a bumper sticker or like a really bad talking point. But what I mean is this: we've got to be investing heavily in our friends, and we have to be really clear-eyed about our adversaries. And that's how the United States put itself in pole position through the 20th century, is we invested heavily in our alliances, and actually too. I don't just mean rhetorically or offering moral support. We had heavy economic investment in fellow democratic countries. And we saw in the 20th century the single biggest explosion in political freedom in the history of the world. I think if you go back to the year 1900, Freedom House, the think tank in Washington, D.C., I think says in the year 1900 there were only a handful of countries in the world that were technically democracies. And the way they define it is universal suffrage. Everyone can vote beyond a certain age, and competitive multi-party elections. So only a couple of countries in the world. By the year 2000, over the span of a century, we went from a tiny fraction of the planet that were democracies to the majority of the planet being democratic. Extraordinary. Probably one of the most extraordinary things that happened in the 20th century. And what we did in foreign policy as the United States across the administrations, whether it was a Republican or a Democrat, is we decided we were going to invest in those countries. We were going to make them our friends, and we were all going to be safer because there's strength in numbers. I believe under the Trump administration, we've seen that formula thrown out the window. That's one of my biggest concerns, actually, about this presidency, is that that consensus, that democratic consensus in U.S. foreign policy, has largely been abandoned. In fact, the president takes a very different view. He wants us to be closer to the Chinese. He wants us to be closer to the Russians. He wants to cut deals with murderous dictators like Kim Jong-un and North Korea. I don't see how it would take a foreign policy expert to look at that and conclude that's a pretty bad way to secure your neighborhood, is to befriend all the gangs and to leave your friends at the curbside.
Why is he doing that? Miles, why do you think he's doing that? I think you're absolutely right that we have a president that seems to hate our allies, and he doesn't seem to understand why we built all those alliances after World War II when we were the strongest country in the world. He doesn't seem to I don't even know how to phrase it, Mike. He hates the whole idea of these alliances and giving money to people in order to build up stronger friends and allies. Hates the idea.
Well, it's part of his America First thing, but I'm going to grind gears here. We're talking to Miles Taylor, chief of staff in a recent Homeland Security configuration under Donald Trump, and has since abandoned his support of Trump and is certainly expressing some fears. Miles Taylor, I want to ask you, like I said, I'm going to grind gears here. I want to go to the immigration thing. I mean, the image of the U.S. putting children in cages, separating families, and as far as I'm concerned, the other image of U.S. citizens tolerating this, that we're not, there's not a million of us in Washington dragging him from the Oval Office to explain why he has put this image of the United States forward, that we have thousands of children in cages. Help me out with this, Miles, please. What policy is this serving? What interest of the United States is locking up children serving?
Well, I think it doesn't. I think you've come into this administration with a United States that still largely had a reputation as, you know, as Reagan used to say, as a shining city on a hill, right? We have a long history of being welcoming towards immigrants, and not just being welcoming towards immigrants. We are a nation of immigrants, words which, by the way, were very, very hard to get the White House to ever put in a document. That would always get crossed out if we sent something to the White House. But we're a nation of immigrants. We are now in the fourth year of the Trump administration, and we do not look like a shining city on a hill. I really believe we now look like Fortress America. We look very unwelcoming, and in fact, we are now very unwelcoming. In fact, before we jump to, you know, family separation at the border, the issue that's got me hot right now is refugees, and it's because I fought the White House every year on this, is in the first year of the Trump administration, people around Donald Trump wanted to slash the number of refugees we admit into the United States, not down to, 30,000. So historically, for the reference of listeners, you know, it's hovered around 50,000, 65,000 a year. Now, there's been dips, right? During wartime and World War II, we didn't admit hardly any refugees in the United States, but we have a historical average. He wanted to slice it down to 40, 30, 20, no, zero.
Wow.
Zero. The White House wanted no refugees admitted into America. So we, and by we I mean the team at the Department of Homeland Security and the State Department, had to fight the White House every year, because for listeners who don't know, there's a process every year where the administration works with Congress and they decide what the number is going to be, what the cap is on refugees. The White House wanted zero, so we had to fight tooth and nail to keep that number higher. But ultimately, it's the president's decision. Now I'm hearing rumors from folks inside the administration that they're already trying to bring the number to historic lows, but that if the president wins re-election, they actually feel confident they can drop that number down to zero. Do you want to live in an America that says we don't welcome anyone? And, I mean, we're not talking about bad guys coming in. We're talking about people who are fleeing violence and persecution in some of the worst corners of the globe, but also who are desperate to commit themselves to the American experiment. They want to come here, work hard, and build new things. And some of the greatest innovations we've had in this country have been people who are refugees or children of refugees. We want that in this country. We want that hunger for freedom. The president really is so fervently opposed to it that he's excited to use that power to drop the number.
As an immigrant, I mean, I'm particularly stunned by this because what's the rationale? Is it just because he thinks it appeals to his base? I mean, there's no rational reason for it.
I wish I could really tell you what was in the president's heart and soul on this. Sincerely, I don't. I couldn't figure it out in that time in the administration. But what I suspected always was is this. When the president talked about good countries, I'll tell you what countries he named, and then I'm going to tell you what bad countries he would talk about. And genuinely, I mean this. I'm not being facetious. When he would talk about places he wanted to increase immigration, we often heard him talk about Nordic countries, Denmark, Finland, Iceland, Norway, mm-hmm. Sweden. He would use those as examples. He would say, you know, can't we bring in more people from Sweden or Norway? When he would talk about bad countries where America was letting in too many people, even though he often had the numbers completely off base, he would mention countries like Haiti, Somalia, Ethiopia, Chad.
Brown countries.
You hit the nail on the head. And I got to say this again. I'm a conservative, a lifelong Republican who went into this administration hoping that the president would give us his best, but he gave us his worst. And in the first year, I would have rolled my eyes at you guys if you said the president is a bigot. And I would have said, no, you know, I don't think he is. He's got policies that look that way. And his heart of hearts, I'm sure he's not a bigot. I'm now telling you on the back end of that service in the administration, I flipped, man. I did a 180, and I think the man himself is actually kind of a bigot because you're absolutely right. When we would have those conversations in the Oval Office or the White House Situation Room, you could only come away thinking, okay, he really doesn't like brown country, but he really loves countries where people have nice, fair skin and blonde hair.
Well, I think he's a clear bigot.
Disgusting.
I think he's a clear bigot. I don't think he's kind of a bigot. There's a nice lady, bartender in my hometown, a few miles from here. She got a naturalized citizen 9 years ago. She had We the People tattooed on her forearm. And every time I go to this establishment, I admire the heck out of her because this. And this was the image of the U.S., not just this Eastern European lady whose country was becoming more and more fascist and came to the United States, did what she had to do to become a citizen, and had We the People tattooed on her arm. This was the image of the United States. In 2020, it certainly is not, and we are much poorer for it.
Miles, I have a question, which is, how did this feel? I mean, Mike is talking about stuff, but how did it feel to try to deal with someone who's this erratic and this racist?
There's only one way to put it. I've used this phrase once before. It was a pride swallowing siege every single day. And I'll say this, and I want to lead off, and no one has to play the violin for me, because I volunteered for this, and I'm a public servant, and this is what I wanted to do. I wanted to make sure that the Department of Homeland Security ran as well as possible and protected Americans as well as possible, but we were constantly thwarted in doing that by the president himself. But it was a pride-swallowing siege because you wanted to really do what you were trained to do in government, and the president on a daily basis made that impossible. In fact, I often say, that his daily tweets were like a weapon of mass disruption while we were literally trying to protect the country against weapons of mass destruction. And that's not an overstatement. I mean, you would wake up in the morning and the first thing I would do every day when I went into DHS was I would get briefed on the latest intelligence. A lot of what the president gets every morning, he gets something called the PDB, the President's Daily Brief, and it's the best information from the intelligence community about threats around the world. Now, Donald Trump often doesn't read it, but we would. we would get there every morning, 5:30, 6 a.m., and the secretary and myself would get our briefing books. We would read it, and then we would have a briefing later in the morning. And then we would focus that day on the threat. And there were some really spooky things that have happened during the Trump administration, bad guys who wanted to do bad things to Americans. And it's our job to look at that every morning and think about how to protect America against it. But as you're reading that briefing book, you might walk out of the secure facility where you read it and see the president's just tweeted six things that he wants done and orders that you've never heard about before that are going to completely disrupt your day and make it difficult for you to do what you were supposed to do, which was go focus on the thing in the briefing book, the bad guy who wants to come in and kill Americans, not have to focus on the president of the United States launching missives out into the public domain about policies that hadn't even been discussed and decided upon the night before. That was enormously frustrating to me as a national security professional. So frustrating that, you know, it almost ruined my marriage. It almost ruined friendships. I mean, it was so destructive to our personal lives because you had to devote twice as much time and attention to your job because handling the president was in and of itself a full-time job, which meant you had to carve out time to actually do your real job. I mean, I was managing a department with the secretary of 250,000 people. That's a $60 billion a year organization. And we had to babysit the commander-in-chief more than we were able to actually run the place. That's a problem. And that should be a problem regardless of your politics.
I think a lot of people can relate to having absolutely erratic and crazy boss. Luckily, I had one in my career. But I hear you when you talk about it, it's kind of personally destructive. It puts you on edge all the time. You don't know what's going to happen. Things change all the time without notice. I understand that that's a real bad feeling.
I want to ask another question. Miles, do you think the Homeland Security is too big? There are too many pieces all in one bureaucracy? Would it be better if there were more independence?
It's a great question. I think in general, it's really important that we don't overreact at the end of the Trump administration and break up DHS. It actually exists for a reason, and I think the benefits have been enormous in terms of better protecting Americans against the vast array of threats out there. What does need to change is something that you, Stuart, noted in the back end of your question, more independence. When we look at something like the FBI, which is much, much smaller than DHS, but when we look at something like the FBI, you have a director who's nominated and confirmed for a five-year tenure. Now, we've obviously seen the president, for political reasons, fire FBI directors, so they're not totally immune. But that idea of a five-year tenure allows someone, or another, you know, agencies, you know, 5 to 10 year tenure, it allows someone to be able to operate with greater independence and not have to be tied to the existing administration. If I was going to offer up one recommendation for DHS after Trump is gone, and how do we prevent this from happening again? How do we prevent the commander-in-chief from meddling inside a law enforcement agency? It would be exactly that. There needs to be more of the senior jobs in DHS need to become apolitical jobs, non-political jobs, and more need to be nominated and confirmed for periods that go beyond presidential administration. That's really important for it to happen. The Department of Homeland Security, people don't realize, is the largest law enforcement agency in America. It's the largest law enforcement department, more so than the Justice Department. And it really needs that separation from politics. So that's really important.
But what's happened with Donald Trump is a complete breakdown of all the norms and expectations and the unwritten rules. I mean, people think the Constitution protects us, and it does, but the Constitution is filled with precedent, with norms, with correct behavior and stuff. And we've seen now that if you elect a certain kind of individual to the presidency, he can just undo 200 years of practices for his own political purpose. He can take entire divisions and turn them into armed agencies of it. I mean, armed in the not the literal sense, armed agencies of his politics. Can we? Is there a better way to resist it? I guess is my question, Miles.
Well, I really think that the bulwark is, you know, first, the government servants around the president. We need good people in government. Second, it's going to be people in the president's party, whether he's a Democrat or Republican. And third, it's going to be the voters. So I want to start on the first one, though, on the people around the president. We've got to always hope that experienced people go into any presidential administration. Now, you know, there's a lot of folks out there who I've talked to as I've been making my way through Arizona and other states who say, you should have never gone into this administration. The president is so bad. And my response is, no, more of us should have gone into this administration because the president is so bad. We don't want our departments and agencies to fall apart and do bad things simply because the commander-in-chief's bad. We need qualified people in there. So I even think if Donald Trump wins re-election, I would encourage people I know that are smart, that know their issues, that work in Washington, D.C., I would say, look, I urge you to go into the Trump administration because we need people who know what they're doing in there. The last thing I want is a group of MAGA-wearing frat boy child soldiers running departments and agencies across the federal government. And that's kind of been what's happened at the back end of the president's first term. The second piece, people in the president's own party, that's where Republicans that I used to work with very closely in Congress, have materially failed the American people. They've failed to stand up to the president. Too few of them have done it. And as a result, the president feels like there are no guardrails, and he's uninhibited in doing what he wants to do. And he's created a culture of fear in the Republican Party. So that leaves the last bulwark. I mean, the last bulwark against a reckless commander-in-chief is the voters themselves. And that's why this election is so completely important, as we are deciding whether to rehire or retire Donald Trump. And that's up to us. And the first two bulwarks have failed, right? Those of us that are, you know, people call it the so-called axis of adults in the beginning of the administration, he purged a lot of them, right? Donald Trump can smell a conscience a mile away, and he'll do anything to eliminate it. They got purged. The Republicans in Congress, they got silent. So, look, at the end of the day, yeah, it's up to us.
I am still surprised, Miles, at the silence in the Republican Party. I understand that they want to get reelected and all that, but when I was growing up, Republicans stood for a kind of hard-necked conservatism, which I disagreed with, but I expected them to act in basically as ethical a way as Democrats did. And I see the whole Republican Party caving before Donald Trump. It's very disturbing. We had some good people who stood up to Donald Trump, even in Arizona. I want to go back over to border issues. How was that decided? I mean, you're trying to do what's a good basis and proposal for the border, as opposed to this erratic, weird child's fantasy of giant walls like the Great Wall in China. What's the logical thing, Miles?
Well, let's jump into that, and let's. I don't want to lose sight of a question that got asked earlier. You guys asked me about family separation, and I don't want you to let me off the hook on that. We really need to talk about that. But I want to answer your question on big picture with the border. And I think the answer is this. We need comprehensive immigration reform in this country and a moderate, compassionate, comprehensive immigration reform. This is the most divisive issue in American politics. So we cannot possibly go to one extreme of Donald Trump or another extreme of so-called open borders. We got to meet in the middle and make sure that we've got a system where our border is secure against drug smugglers, human traffickers, and bad guys who want to bring bad things into this country, but also that our front door is open, that we're not slashing the number of refugee admissions, that we're not closing the doors to people who come from impoverished regions of the world, that we're open and welcoming. We've got to meet somewhere in the middle there. My frustration on immigration inside of the Trump presidency was that all he cared about, when we talked about that pie earlier, if that whole pie was immigration, that whole pie that is Department of Homeland Security, even though the slices should be all other things, when it came to immigration, within that pie, the majority of it for him was the wall. I call it his wall or nothing approach to governing. And the president was so obsessed with the border wall that he didn't spend any time or political capital working with Congress to actually solve the underlying issues behind the border crisis. And that is the laws themselves. I mean, the president needed to work with Congress to fix some of the laws so that people could be processed more quickly through our system. And what do I mean by that? I mean, right now, if I'm, let's say I'm from Guatemala and all of my family was killed by a gang, and I flee to the United States, and I just want a fresh start. I want to come to the freest nation on earth, and I sneak across. It's illegal to sneak across the border. It's called entry without inspection. It's against the law. It's on the books. Okay, I get caught sneaking across. What happens next is that I get put into a system where it takes potentially 7 to 10 years for the U.S. justice system to tell me whether I can claim asylum in the United States. So I tell the officer that picks me up, hey, I'm fleeing violence. I want to claim asylum. It would be great if they told me within, you know, a month, 2 months, 6 months that, okay, you've been approved. You can be here. You are going to become an American. Instead, it takes 7 to 10 years. And by that point, after a decade of living here, I'm going to feel like an American no matter what. Hell, this will have been my home for a decade. But the fact that at the end of that process, I still might find out, oh, the courts ruled against me. They're deporting me back to Guatemala, where my family members were all killed by a gang. And, oh, by the way, the gang's looking for me. That's screwed up. Any American should look at that and say, that system is screwed up. We should be able to more quickly process those claims and tell people whether they get to join our great experiment in freedom. And if not, then compassionately to work with them to relocate them, if not back to their home country, then to a safe third country where they could be. That's not the way the system works today, and the president did not care about that. He only cared about that wall, so much so that you guys have probably heard me talking about the crazy ideas he would have on a daily basis for the wall. We got phone calls from the president, not joking phone calls, not fake phone calls, real phone calls from the commander-in-chief saying things like, I want you guys to look into how we could build a moat at the border in front of the border wall and put alligators and snakes in it to scare off the migrants. And he actually wanted us to develop cost estimates on that. He wanted us to devote our time away from our day jobs of protecting Americans against threats to run the numbers on how much it would take to feed snakes and alligators in a giant moat in front of the border. He wasn't joking, and it was insane. That shouldn't be what we're paying attention to. When we're talking about immigration, we shouldn't be thinking up sick ways to kill migrants or put them in danger. We should be thinking of ways to figure out how to humanely deal with the situation and welcome people into our country.
It's an extraordinarily bad consciousness, bad mind, and I know the psychologists are all arguing whether he's a narcissistic personality or whether he's a sociopath or whether he's a borderline personality, which seems to me what fits better. But it doesn't really matter because we've seen for almost four years exactly what he does. It doesn't matter in a sense. I mean, I ask you, why is he doing this stuff? But it doesn't really matter because we see what he does, right?
Mm-hmm.
Miles, let me ask a question that you may not want to answer. Assuming he loses the election but refuses to leave, who and how would that situation be taken care of, do you think?
That's a dark question, isn't it? And we're all kind of asking ourselves that. And that's another one of those that a few years ago, you know, if you'd asked me, I would have said, come on, you know, that's never going to happen. And now we face the prospect of a president who doesn't want to leave. And that's not us being recklessly speculative. The president has given us enough reason to speculate because he even said to his supporters a few weeks ago, if I lose this election, it is because it is rigged. So the president has now said that there's not a scenario where he can legitimately lose. I think that leads to all sorts of very scary outcomes that are threatening to our democratic process and to stability nationwide. I think there's a real fear about civil unrest. Now, the president can still fix that. He can check his rhetoric. He can cool down the temperature on this issue. And also Republicans should be holding him accountable. But I want to answer your question directly. If that happens, quite frankly, I don't know what we do. Obviously, we have law enforcement in this country. Obviously, if you know, a new president is elected and an old one refuses to leave, there are mechanisms in place. But it's not anything that people in government have ever had to think about, at least not in this century. And when I talk to friends that are still serving in the administration, which I do, in the White House and other departments and agencies, they've said, you know, as the president has tweeted some of these things out, that went from an absurd fantasy concept is something that people kind of had to scratch their heads and think about. Now, I don't want to be recklessly speculative. And so do I think that's going to happen? No, I don't think that's going to happen here in the United States. I really do think if the president loses, even if he has to lose in the courts, you know, he'll see the presidency and we'll have a peaceful transition of power. I really believe that'll happen. I'm not terrified about that scenario, but the fact that we're talking about it is what concerns me. And the president has created an environment where we have to talk about and ask questions like that. That's what's concerning.
So all the time that we've been worried about cybersecurity for our elections and for just for the country, Donald Trump has been totally uninterested in that, did not encourage you folks to do anything about it. You had to sort of do it in your spare time.
I'm glad you asked that question because I can't remember right now. I can't remember a single briefing that we did with the president on cybersecurity threats. I'm trying to rack my brain. I could be a little bit wrong. Maybe there was one or two. But again, DHS is the nation's top cybersecurity department. We're the ones that protect federal networks and protect Americans against cyber intrusions. And there's obviously other wonderful agencies, you know, national security agencies, Pentagon. A lot of people do great work in that space. But DHS is at the tip of the spear. And rarely did we get to talk to the president about those issues because he was not interested. And we would push the White House. In fact, I'm going to tell you something that I haven't told a lot of folks. There was a conversation we had with Mick Mulvaney. He was White House Chief of Staff after John Kelly. And we went over to him and we said, Mick, we used to do something in the Bush administration called Terror Tuesdays. And that's when the terror threat was very high. And the Secretary of Homeland Security once a week would go brief the president on all the terror threats. And they would go through the administration's response and how they were going to handle it. And we said, what we want to do is start something with the president called Threat Thursday, where we have dedicated time with the commander-in-chief where we can go through what we see as the biggest threats to the country, whether it's cyberspace or foreign interference or anything along those lines, and then get that time to work with him to address those threats. The answer we got was no. The answer we got was, he's not going to be interested, we're not going to do that, and it never ended up getting set up. So the president of the United States didn't even have a weekly time on his calendar to meet with his Homeland Security Secretary to talk about all these dangers to the country, including the extraordinary threats we faced in cyberspace. That didn't mean we didn't address those threats. Of course we did. In fact, there's some great things that happened to the Trump administration to protect Americans against cyber dangers. But we would have been able to do a lot more if the president of the United States himself had actually cared.
An extraordinary story. I think we've got a couple of minutes left, Tom. What would you sum up your experience in the administration and why you left and so many others didn't? Because for a lot of people, you're a hero because you took a stand. You got 1 minute.
I appreciate that. I've got a minute. Is that what you said?
Yeah.
Well, look, I'd say this. I left because saying no to the president was no longer enough. And I'd go back and do it again. I'd go back and serve in this administration again because, really, if you'd seen some of the things on a daily basis that the president wanted to do, it was bonkers. There's no other way to put it. I mean, he wanted to do things that were immoral, unethical, and in many cases illegal. And there were really good people there at the beginning of the administration to say no. My concern is that the equation has flipped. We've gone from a mostly qualified administration to a mostly unqualified administration of people who are willing to just be yes men. I mean, the Oval Office itself has become an echo chamber. So that's why I had to leave. But, you know, my last message to folks would be this. Our national character is not the same as Donald Trump's character. And this is, if anything, a character election. Who we vote for is going to say a lot about who we are. So we have a very important opportunity here, not just to elect a new president, but to tell the world what the fabric of the American Republic looks like and what our national character actually is. And that's why I think this is so vitally important. And that's why politics doesn't matter this time. Left and right doesn't matter. Right and wrong is what's going to matter in this election.
Thank you, Miles Taylor, for being with us. I think it was a great discussion. I think I like the fact that you took an ethical stand. I know some excellent people are still in there trying to ameliorate things, but thank you for being with Democratic Perspective.
You've been listening to Democratic Perspective, brought to you by the Verde Valley Independent Democrats, a weekly talk show focusing on the political issues facing the Verde Valley, Sedona, Northern Arizona, and our nation at large. Catch us every Monday morning after the 8 a.m. news, right here on AM 780 KAZN. It's beautiful out there, folks. Have a great day.